Australian Aviation Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Brass, and today on the show, I'm joined by RAAF pilot Flight Lieutenant John Towski. And as you'll hear, JT has had an incredible career in the Air Force with over 27 years experience and thousands of hours across several different aircraft types. His most recent role as a PC-21 instructor at 2FTS sees him at the very leading edge of flight training in the world with the new PC-21 and the revolutionary training aids that accompany it. But before we get into the interview, I wanted to ask you quickly, have you got the latest edition of the Australian Aviation Magazine? Now, if you don't have your membership yet, you can head on over to our website at australianaviation.com.au and you can pick up a digital membership for as little as just 99 cents per week. Now, make sure you follow along on Facebook and Instagram for the latest industry news, and make sure you pop on over to the website because that's updated daily as well. Now, if you have a question or you've got some feedback for the show, you can reach out to us at any time with an email at mail@australianaviation.com.au. Okay, let's kick off today's podcast and get JT on the show. Well, I'm here with Flight Lieutenant John Towski. Welcome to the Australian Aviation Podcast, JT. It's great to have you here, mate.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Rob.
I'm really looking forward to this one because we did a podcast with Mark Jessup down at the Avalon Air Show, and we were talking about the magic carpet ride, and there was these really cool formations with PC-9, PC-21, and Mark was lucky enough to get in the back seat of a PC-21 while you happened to be flying it. But before we get into the front end of that and talk about all of that, you've spent quite a long time in the Air Force, and I just wanted to get to know you a little bit and help the listeners get to know you a little bit after, 27 years in the RAAF? That's incredible. That's a long career, mate.
Yeah, well, look, thanks, Rob. It's been off and on for a while, actually. I did 20 years after joining in the Jurassic period there in 1984 through the RAF Academy, and then graduated from the Australian Defence Force Academy in its first year in 86. Then on the pilot's course and flew some aircraft there, did 20 years from the Air Force and got out for a while, did some contracting overseas and back in as a reservist and having a great time, Rob.
So the total amount of time in the Air Force, it's not end-to-end 27, but it's the total amount of time you've done is 27 years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it's been a great ride. Really enjoyed it so far.
You must be of the ADF, I guess, era where you would do 20 years and you'd have a good DFRDB at the end of it and that type of thing. Was that the incentive to leave after 20 years, or was it time to kind of move on and try some new things too?
Interesting question, mate, because after I'd done about 3 years, they made us make a decision whether it be DFRDB or MSBS. And the gouge there was you had to decide after I'd been in 3 years whether I was going to do 20. Oh. And it was a difficult choice, mate. Most of us went to MSBS, which meant that you got a better package if you didn't do 20, and the DFRDB guys were rewarded if they stuck out the 20. So I went with MSBS, and it's not that I've received a cent yet, but apparently it's meant to be pretty good.
So for the people that are listening that don't know what that is, the DFRDB scheme was the old school scheme where you would get a pension at the end of your 20 years, and then the MSBS was the transition over to the new scheme. And I recall I joined the military in 1994, and I think I was there for 3 months of DFRDB opportunity. So I got 3 months of a pension coming somewhere later in my life, I think. And yeah, for me, it's all MSBS as well. But you started off at ADFA. You went through. What degree did you get when you were at ADFA?
A science degree, Rob. We didn't have too much choice in those days, so it was a Bachelor of Science and graduated from there in its first year in 86.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever used that degree for anything?
Yeah, actually, believe it or not, obviously, it was quite technical dealing with asymptotics and astrophysics and all of that stuff. But what it did help me was able to calculate things quickly. So mathematics became relatively automatic, which is really handy in the cockpit.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I know a lot of people that go and get a degree, whether that's from ADFA or somewhere else, and just never use the bloody thing. So it's good to know that you made use of the time that you were there and it happened for you. Did you always want to be a pilot, or did that happen through ADFA and while you were there?
No, always, Rob. One of those classic cases of wanted to be a pilot since I was in kindergarten, and I've had the passion the whole time, and lucky enough to get a gig into the Air Force when I finished school and went from there. So it was just following a dream.
So back in the day after you finished your degree, did you join in the Air Force or did you just go to ADFA as like general entry? How did that work back in the day?
Well, how it works is you're recruited as a cadet into the RAF. And in those days, it was the RAF Academy, which is based at Point Cook. So you're trained as a military cadet whilst you undertake a degree. ADFA started in 86, so we transferred there, Rob, and continued the third year of the degree. And then after graduation as a military cadet there, attended pilot school.
Were you in a minority wearing a blue uniform, or was there more Army guys and Navy guys there, or was it like an even spread there?
No, it was very, the Air Force was very outnumbered, so we really had to maintain the passion because we didn't often see blue suiters around at that time. In fact, in my division, I was the only Air Force.
Oh, wow.
Third year. So,
oh, wow.
Having a cockpit picture on the wall was pretty handy and daily motivational tool for me to remember that I was there to fly planes, hopefully.
Were there any other guys or girls there that were wanting to be aviators as well at the same time? Did you have a little thing going on there with the crowd of yours?
Well, absolutely. It was an interesting transition, Rob, because the third years were all pilots. There was about 40 of us who went there. But the second and first years below us had all different sorts of mustering, so engineers and that sort of thing. So the years below us, there were people from all different trades undergoing their degrees there.
Oh, very nice. And so fast forward a little bit for me, take me through the career. You finish at ADFA, then you go to, where do you go through first, to Tamworth? Was it back there and back in your day?
No, back in my day, it was Point Cook, 1FTS at Point Cook on the mighty plastic parrot, the CT-4, and graduating from there, then off the Pierce to fly the mighty Mackie just before it was retired in 86. So that was a bit of a thrill there, going solo in the Mackie jet at Gin Gin there in Pierce, and then graduated from Pierce and then off to the VIP squadron in Canberra.
What were you flying there, Falcons?
They didn't have the Falcon 900 when I got there. They had what's called the Draggy or the HS-748, which was a large turboprop. But very quickly, I was onto the Falcon 20, the little pocket rocket, which was a great toy, flying the ministers around. And then I was lucky enough to be trained in the US and bring the Falcon 900 back from the USA in 1989, and a fantastic glass cockpit that aircraft was.
So you went from astrophysics at university to bizjet pilot shortly after. That's a cool transition, right?
Well, that's one of the cool things of the Air Force. You know, at 21, you're staying in five-star hotels and flying around the world. It's a fantastic gig.
And tell me, when you're flying the Air Force business jets, I guess, so to speak, or what did you call them? What are they called inside the Air Force?
VIP jets.
VIP jets, that's the proper terminology. So you're flying the VIPs, though, politicians and obviously VIPs. That you must be on like super tight schedules, going flight planning to places that you never thought you'd ever visit ever in your life. It must be a really interesting experience.
Yeah, it was, Rob. Those were in the days of no mobile, so people had pagers, and often it would go off and you'd be at work in a couple of hours planning to go maybe overseas or short notice around the country. And I guess that's the nature of the political business, is we had to be on standby and ready to go at certain times.
Was there any sort of places that you can remember, you know, you cast your mind back all those years, that really stick out to you, that were crazy approaches or sort of like, hey man, this is kind of a dangerous place, we don't have many outs here, that type of thing?
I can remember going across the country to Exmouth one day and landing there, but the minister had already left, so we had to turn around and come home. So that was a bit of a waste. But look, there's plenty of fun times at that squadron, mainly because we did what the ministers did. If they stayed at five-star, so did we, because we had to be sort of nearby them without mobiles and things. And it was a good time. Very, very fond memory.
What about being close up with politicians and seeing what they do on a day-to-day basis? I mean, everybody's got an opinion about politicians and politics in this country. All you got to do is ask a couple of people, but, you know, you got to be careful what you're asking and the conversation that you end up in. But what was it like to see what they did up close? You know, tell us some good things about what they did.
You could see they were real people. You know, they had, some of them had children, and you could actually hear them talk off camera, and they were real people. You could hear the highs and the lows of their life. And, you know, there were times there where we'd come back in the middle of the night in Canberra, strong crosswinds, maybe 3 or 4 degrees, and you know, it was challenging conditions to put them down safely, and they'd come up and shake your hand and thank you very much. And it was an interesting feeling to be known that they were trusting you with the job, and it was pretty satisfying to be able to do that.
Yeah, sounds great. Did you ever sync up with the Prime Minister? Was it, you ever fly that? You must have flown the Prime Minister around a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember one flight we did where the Prime Minister was between the seats, and he had a mega press gallery set up in Canberra there. It was a beautiful day above the clouds, but the fog in Canberra started a couple of hundred feet above the ground, so we sunk down into the fog trying to land about three times when he tapped us on the shoulder and said, "You better try and land the next one," and luckily we did.
You got in there. Did you ever get on with little Johnny Howard, or was it Paul Keating? Who was it?
It was Bob Hawke? Paul Keating when I was there, yeah. Bob and Paul in the late 80s and early 90s.
Oh, no way. I used to have an office down in Oxford Street here in Sydney, and it was where the Labor Party office was, and Bob Hawke used to come in and out all the time. And I can remember thinking the first time I saw him, it's Bob Hawke. And I can remember being in the lift one time, and Bob Hawke came in the lift, and it was just him and I in the lift. We're kind of just chatting there for a little bit, and he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, well, that's what it's like. You get to know them as people, and they sit sometimes between the seats on a nice long leg and tell you about some of their experiences in life. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a fantastic time in a young Air Force pilot's career. And tell us about some of the other types that you'd flown. You flew Caribou as well. That's something close and dear to my heart as a paratrooper, that's for sure.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I actually chose to go there because whilst the VIP aircraft is very modern, it's all autopilot and very automated, and it was a wonderful opportunity for me to go to an aircraft that is just hands and feet, rudder and yoke. And it was great flying that aircraft back to sort of 1940s technology with the two radial engines and the beautiful sound of freedom. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed my time at 35 Squadron and going up to Papua New Guinea and doing all the different roles that it did, including many for the Army and airdrops and, as you mentioned, parachuting and obviously tactical transport. And that was an absolutely magic posting. I was lucky enough to spend 7 years on Caribou, and what a great aircraft.
Yeah, I have very fond memories of the old Boo as a paratrooper, and going up to altitude. It was the slow boat to get up there, let me tell you. It felt like it took forever to get to altitude down in Nowra, but there was always something to look at out the window there, and you would get out of the thing, and it depends, you know, if you're doing static line or free fall or something like that. It was always fun to get a big run up and run out the single aisle of the back of the plane and down the big slippery dip. That was kind of how I described it. It was great fun as a soldier to do that. But the thing would be on the ground in no time at all. It would get down and stop on a 50-cent piece, turn around and, okay, boys, open the ramp, get back in, let's go again type thing. It was an incredible machine, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It was, and even these days, we haven't really got anything to strictly replace it. You know, it can put 28,000 pounds down on a 1,200-foot strip, you know, 7,000 feet up. It's a pretty capable piece of kit when it was fully operational. I really enjoyed flying it. It was... you really had to fly accurately, especially in short strips and especially at night, some of the landings on the tactical air land system lights. And the good thing about it, Rob, was variety. You're always doing something different, whether it's low nav, airdrops, para, great aircraft. Really enjoyed it.
What's it like operating hot and high in the highlands of PNG in a radial engine aircraft? My gosh.
Well, in those days, there was basically no GPS, so it was the nav dividers and a map, and relying on both of us looking at maps, and the main rule up there was stay out of the cloud,
yeah.
And some big cumulus granitus in some of those clouds, so stay out of the cloud, and back to raw data sort of navigation. So that was one of the challenges, was to be able to do that, because often most of the mountaintops were shrouded in clouds, and it just all looks the same, and so it's a matter of coming back to what I was saying before about mathematics and 1-in-60 rule and working out drift and ground speeds and just fantastic pilot skill development vehicle to be able to hone your flying skills and also your thinking and always coming up with plan B in case something goes wrong. So just a great aircraft.
Now you just brought it on home for me, JT. That was like an experience that I just really enjoyed that description, because I remember when I did my commercial pilot's navigation exam, I like studied hard for that. I was working hard for it, and I did the exam and I passed. I think I got like 96% or something like that. I worked hard for that one. And I remember coming out of the CASA place at Bankstown Airport, sitting in my car and just throwing up my hands thinking, what was all that for in the days of glass cockpits and GPS? That just seemed like
the most ridiculous thing in the whole world. And everything that you just said, everything that you just described was in that exam. And it still holds true today, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, one of the pleasures that I do on a weekend every now and then is fly a Warbird, and that's back to raw data as well. You know, ground speed calculations and looking out the window, navigating. It's a skill that I'm glad that I've honed.
And the fundamentals never change no matter what, right? And you know, I kind of learnt to fly myself in the days before GPS and glass cockpits as well, you know, which is not that long ago, really, in the scheme of things. And now fast forward to these glass cockpits and all the GPS and stuff like that, I know that if I fly an aeroplane today, that my skill set still rests on those foundations as well. Is it the same for you? You still, that's where you come from, right? They're the roots.
Absolutely. It's good to have that in your toolbox. And I certainly hope that that sort of skill set doesn't wither away with the automation that we're faced with these days. So, I do see that it's still embedded in the ATPL studies for airline pilots, and it's certainly captured in Air Force training as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got a lot of experience in training, and particularly on the PC-9. How many hours in total did you rack up, or have you racked up in the PC-9?
Jeez, almost 5,000 flying that aircraft. Yeah, I really enjoyed that as well.
You must be one of the highest time PC-9 pilots in RAAF, right?
Well, I haven't been counting, mate, but I guess I've been doing it for a while, yeah.
That wasn't a dig. That was like a subtle compliment there.
No, I appreciate that, mate. Look, I'm not really keeping tabs on who else has got a lot of hours. There are a lot of experienced guys out there, and you know, the aircraft, as you know, the RAF have had it for over 30 years. So I'm sure there's a few people out there with some more experience than me.
I remember as a young fella, I think I've told this story a couple of times on the podcast. I lived over in a place in Sydney called Bass Hill, which is two suburbs from Bankstown Airport. And as a young fella, one of the girls that I went to school with, her dad was one of the test pilots for the PC-9s that were being assembled at Bankstown Airport at Hawker de Havilland. And when I found out about that, I was crazy about airplanes when I was a kid. I remember standing at the fence at Bankstown Airport watching these things doing touch and goes, and you know, there was three or four of them in the sky at the same time, and they, you know, they'd assemble them, send them out, and off they go. And you know, just at Avalon Air Show a couple of weeks ago when we met down there, that's kind of bye-bye PC-9, see you later. So I guess if you live long enough, you see everything twice, and here we are again, full circle with the PC-21. Pretty incredible machine, right?
Oh, the PC-21 is exciting. It's a fantastic platform and really enjoying flying it. But you're right, I was there at Avalon and I shed a tear. You know, I was a little bit emotional with the old PC-9. It's been a big part of my life and it's just been a fantastic platform for the Air Force.
And it came along at the right time, didn't it? Because the Mackie kind of went the way of the Dodo because of the cracks in the wings. Is that right? Do I remember the story correctly? And they parked up the Mackie, right? And then they replaced it with the PC-9.
Yeah, look, the Mackie was just getting old, like any aircraft that's subject to fatigue life and G-forces and things, and they had to keep up with new technology, and the PC-9 turned out to be a fantastic long-surviving selection, and I sort of saw it come in just after I finished pilot's course there in 1989. It came in and basically ran for 30 years, so yeah, a magnificent servant to the Air Force.
Did you put your hand up to go and do some instructing on that? Because obviously that's how you've racked up so many hours on it as an instructor, or was that a posting that was given to you?
Well, it's a little bit of a story there. I was actually out of the Air Force in the reserves, just taking some time off for a while. I was riding motorcycles, which is one of my passion there on the side, working in the motorcycle industry, doing a little bit of reserve time, when the Air Force actually contacted me and said they had a slot on PC-9s as an instructor. I had some experience. Would I be interested in transferring from active reserve back in for full time?
Right.
And I jumped the opportunity, to be honest, Rob, and came down to sail here, did the course, and then off to 2FTS and never looked back since.
And of all the students that you have, is there any that stick out in your mind, if maybe one or two of them are listening?
Oh, there's a few there. There's some absolute stars that I'd like to think I've had an input into them becoming great aviators, but most probably not. But look, there's some guys, unfortunately, and girls that I've just done my best and they haven't made it. But flying's not for everybody. So all I know is when I get into the cockpit, I just do my best, and it's really satisfying to see your blogsy, your student progress. and that's why I've been doing it so long. It's just a very satisfying pastime.
I was going to say, it takes nerves of steel to be a flying instructor. That's the first thing, because I've been a student and seen the flying instructor sit there with his hands in his lap and have nerves of steel. How do you know how to let the student go? When are you going to pull them up? How do you let them know that hey, that's a mistake, and let them make that mistake before it becomes unsafe?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is you don't really. You learn from experience. And one of the good things about CFS is that you won't be released to instruct until you've had a fully qualified instructor playing the role of blog in the aircraft. So you've sort of done it quite a bit by the time you're actually categorized as an instructor. So you've seen a little bit of it. It's only really when you get to the live school with real trainees that your experience bucket starts to fill up. And after a while, you get a feel for when the hairs are rising on the back of your neck there. And certainly early on, I was relatively conservative, and probably for a good reason. But after a while, you sort of get to see and get the feel for what's going to happen next.
And did watching other people learn how to fly and teaching them and watching them go through that process, did it help you with your actual, like, hands and feet flying itself?
Absolutely. I mean, when you go to the training school to learn, CFS, to learn to become an instructor, you're surrounded by some guys there who've done it for, you know, 20 years, and you just need to be a sponge and soak it up. And they've got so many stories to tell about lessons they've learned, and the idea is to surround yourself with people who know more than you do, and that's not hard when you're a junior instructor arriving at 2FDS. And the Air Force has got a very good mentoring program where they actually have a set program that works you up to different categories. You start as a DCAT and work hard and prove yourself and fly safe, and after a certain amount of experience and basically minimal sort of errors, you get looked at to be upgraded to CCAT and then eventually to BCAT. So it's a very good mentoring program, and it's an excellent development tool to turn instructors into highly qualified ones.
Yeah, sounds absolutely fantastic. And I understand you did a stint in the in that blue flying suit as well as a roulette. Is that right?
I did, mate, and I have to say that was one of the highlights of my career. A fantastic opportunity was given to me, and I really enjoyed that gig. Hard work in the air, believe it or not. It doesn't. It looks all smooth and looks like nothing much is going on in terms of movement of the stick, but it's a little bit like the duck on water. Everything's moving underneath the surface, so it's hard work, but really satisfying when you get the job done and land with your team. Because one of the big things I enjoyed was the camaraderie, Rob, with the guys there. Everybody's got each other's life in their hands, and you're doing it sort of daily, and you really trust the guys. And the camaraderie and the teamwork and the professionalism and the safety culture was just outstanding.
Yeah, the ADF is the best team sport in the world. Absolutely no doubt about that at all. What number roulette were you?
I started at number 3, which is on the left-hand side of lead there, and then slipped into what they call slot boy, number 4, mm-hmm. which is directly behind the leader.
Right, and when you're in number 3, you're looking out the right-hand side of your aircraft at the lead?
Yeah, so you get very strong right-hand neck muscles.
I was going to say, you're like looking out the window the whole time to the right like that, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, and of course you don't want to take your eye off lead for more than a split second, so absolutely, yeah, looking out to the right for about a year.
And formation flying is one of the fundamentals of any Air Force pilot, right? And you learn that while you're in training, you learn that while you're in a squadron and whatnot. But what about in the roulettes? You kind of go in next level with that formation training, right?
Yeah, look, absolutely. They undergo all qualified flying instructors selected for the roulettes have to undergo an upgrade program, and that's approximately 30 missions.
Wow.
Starting with low-level aerobatics so that you're comfortable with flying aerobatics close to the ground, and then you work up in 2-ship, 4-ship, 6-ship, and then eventually you step it down from 3,000 feet down to all the way down to 200 feet. So that build up is quite extensive, and obviously you need to pass every mission and be assessed as being safe. So it's a very thorough process before you actually cleared for a public display.
Yeah, right. It's a long, long lead into it. I got to humanize this a little bit, right? Because as the flying instructor, the roulette and all of that career stuff that you got behind you, did you struggle with anything? Was anything there that was difficult that you had to fly a couple of times?
I did, Rob. Well, one of the new things in the roulettes that you don't normally do as a general flying instructor teaching formation is what's called line of breast. And line of breast is where you basically put your wingtip, the wingtip of the leader. And that's quite a challenging position to fly, especially under G-forces and all of that. So I found that a challenge because I hadn't done a lot of that. So it was a matter of getting out there and practicing until I became comfortable with it.
And what's the hard maneuver? Did you do like a barrel roll or a loop line abreast? What sort of maneuver are you doing there that's under G?
Generally in that position, the line abreast is loops and barrel rolls. So, yeah, they can be quite a challenge there because sometimes you've got someone flying off your left wing as well. So you've got to make sure that you're in the position for your teammate to your left or right as well.
And if you're in the number three position looking out the right-hand side of your window there and you're closing up a little bit and how do you know not to step out too far, or you're just relying on the guy to your left to make sure that he steps out as you do that as well? Is that how it works?
Well, it's all teamwork, as I touched on before. He knows that I'm doing my best to stay in position. And if I'm slightly out of position, it's all about being predictable and nice, slow movements. If I'm out of position, I'll grease back into position and so that there's nothing that's going to surprise anybody.
Yeah, no big movements, right? Just gently does it easy,
correct,
does it into that formation. Tell me about the roulettes as I saw them at Avalon Air Show just recently a couple of weeks ago. Those boys working hard in the sky, flying, doing their thing and fitting within the boundaries of the air show timings and whatnot, but they get on the ground and they're straight out of the aeroplane and doing the PR thing. That looked like it was pretty full on, and being part of that squadron and traveling around the country and doing that constantly, that must have been pretty hard work, right?
Yeah, well, I would say for those guys on the Avalon Air Show, it would have been very hard work. As you saw there, it was over sort of 39, 40 degrees, Rob. And, of course, when it's that sort of temperature, the air conditioning is, let me say, average in the PC-9. So they wouldn't have got a lot of airflow there. And, of course, as soon as it's hot, it's also turbulent. So they would have been working pretty hard on those days to stay in position. So I'd imagine by the time they got on the ground, they would have been fairly shagged. But, of course, the roulette being the premier flag waving exercise for the RAF, it's pretty important that the guys get out and press the flesh, and that's what it's all about to me. It's to hand out a sticker to a young guy, to sign a poster, to share an ice cream, a couple of ice creams with some people, and just engage. And that's what it's all about. And I think that's a really important part, and the guys do it very well.
Yeah, and I have to say, in the ADF, I've been lucky enough to experience that a couple of times in two different services in the Army and the Navy. In the Navy, we used to have an open ship, and the public would come on the ships. And, you know, it's a pretty rare thing to have the general public come and talk about what you do on a day-to-day basis, and people would just kind of love it. And I remember it being a really rewarding experience to be able to share that with the general public. Can you remember some things that stand out in your mind? Was there an event that you really remember that was a highlight of your roulette's career?
They're all highlights, mate. They're all highlights.
It's all fun, right? It's all great fun.
Yeah, there was no bad show. And it was really, for me, the opportunity to land and meet the people. So sometimes it's a bit frustrating when you come into a show and you fly off and you land somewhere else. But to be able to engage with the public, for me, was great. I mean, you know, we did Clipsal, we did the standard Formula One motorcycle Grand Prix. One of the ones that did stand out actually was the Canteen Kids, where we went and met those guys, put on some bandanas, and just the joy on their faces looking at the cockpits of the aircraft and talking to them and their parents. That was really touching.
Yeah, that's very nice. Very nice and well said. Well, that's a nice little transition. As I mentioned at the top of the show here today, recently, our photographer, Mark Jessup, was lucky enough to jump in the back seat of the PC-21 that you were flying on, a magic carpet ride. And the video really did show that it was a magic carpet ride. So we got Mark's perspective as a photographer of what that's like and what it's like as a civilian to go on an Air Force plane and to do all those sorts of things. But I'm really interested to know from your perspective what it's like to take somebody or to take a photographer out like that and to be part of a historical event like that.
Oh, look, Mark was your perfect passenger. Great guy, very professional. And, you know, he liaised with me before the mission because we obviously had a rough route that we were going to fly and he wanted to make sure that he'd get the shots he needed, bearing in mind the angle of the sun and what would be behind the formation. So we had a rough plan before we went based on the navigation that the guys were going to do. And it just ran like a storybook as we went flying. And he's a real trooper, fantastic. Obviously skills with the camera, and he just pushed me around where he wanted me, high, low, faster, slower, up, down, and I just put the aircraft there, and he took some great shots. So no credit to me. It was all Mark Jessup. So a fantastic job.
Oh, that's well said. That's very humbly said as well. For the people listening that don't know what we're referring to, there was a formation of 12 PC-9s and 4 PC-21s. Do I have those numbers right?
No, I think it was closer to about 9 PC-9s and 5 21s, something like that. We had one break shortly after start. But, mainly PC-9s, the ones that were serviceable here from East Sale. We got airborne, put into the magic carpet, and then had a following cadre of PC-21s behind it. And then, of course, I was the other photo chase. So, it looked good from the air, and I'd invite your listeners to have a look at some of the pictures there on Australian Aviation that Mark took some cracking shots.
Yeah, we got a great in-cockpit video as well with a 360 camera that you can drag around on the screen, which is really cool. You can see that on YouTube and also in Facebook as well. One of the things that I noticed and I wanted to ask you about actually was that formation. There's a lot of aeroplanes in that formation. There's a lot of stuff happening in a small space of sky. But you guys were quite low and the cloud base was quite low on the day as well. What happens if somebody in the middle of the formation has a problem? Do they pull up or do they push down? Where do they go? How do you get out if there's a problem?
Yeah, good question, Rob. It's what you may not have heard Mark talk about was the solid 1 hour briefing in regards to the formation before we take off. So it's really quite specific about each team member's role in that formation. Not only normal operations, as in what frequency changes, what formation positions we're going to be, call signs, weather, notices to airmen, NOTAMs, the plan, where we're going, what we're doing, but also abnormal situations. So what happens if someone does have a problem? Who deals with that? Who's the leader of the sub-formations? So it's a very, very detailed briefing. And, of course, the formation leader, who was squadron leader Jay Puffley, he invites questions at the end of that briefing for anyone who has any subsequent queries in relation to how to fly that. So very thoroughly briefed, and everybody had their roles and were ready for problems. And in fact, we had one shortly after takeoff with one of the PC-9s having an indication problem that had to return to sail, and that was handled in accordance with the brief and therefore safely.
Nice and simple, really. You just make it seem like it's standard to put all those aeroplanes in that little place, in that little space of sky.
Well, it sounds simple, mate, but I can tell you it was a relatively complex formation with different aircraft types and all of the requirements that needed to be done in the flight in terms of photos. And, of course, we only had a two-minute window, really, to be overhead Avalon to enable the flight path of Avalon. So it was a time on target as well, and airspace and traffic that were unexpected. And as you said, the cloud base, which was sitting just above us. So it was a relatively challenging flight, but I thought ran quite smoothly considering.
Do you ever pinch yourself and go, how did we get all of those people to do exactly what we wanted them to do? That's kind of cool.
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, the magic carpet is just fun. It's a fun part of what we do, and opportunities for fun come and go, and it's important to grab them when you can. And, with the skill set that we have, where we generally from day to day fly two-ship formations, sometimes four-ship formation, the chance to have 15 aircraft and celebrate the retirement of the aircraft and to reward some of the salient people who've been involved in that, the Pilatus guys and the air flight guys, is a fantastic opportunity for it to all happen. It was a great way to celebrate the retirement of the PC-9.
Yeah, fantastic. And you were lucky enough to be flying along in a PC-21. One thing that I did notice in the video that Mark produced for us that we watched is you got around the formation like it was just like nothing. It was so effortless. And it looks like the PC-21 has quite a bit more power available to it than what the PC-9 does. Is that right?
Yeah, it does. Look, it's like they went to a pilot and said, okay, mate, we're going to make a new aircraft. You're flying the PC-9 now. What do we need to do? And any pilot would say, well, give us more power and give us some modern equipment inside, give us an autopilot, a head-up display and a really good air conditioning system, and they have. And the aircraft is quite a bit faster. It goes up to 370 knots.
Wow. And
unlike the PC-9, which has got around 950 shaft horsepower, this aircraft has 1,600. So
wow.
A little bit heavier, but certainly a fair bit more performance. So that enabled us to zip around the formation a little bit. and to manoeuvre into position that Mark requested with relative ease.
You forgot one really important point there, JT. The aeroplane is just, like, beautiful to look at. It's a really nice-looking machine on the ground too, right?
Yeah, look, it's a fantastic aircraft and really looking forward to being a part of the training that we're about to, or in fact, we are delivering to training instructors and training new trainees on that platform. It's a fantastic piece of kit and happy to talk about it.
Well, things have changed radically with that aircraft and the way that pilots train on the new hardware that's in the Air Force. I was lucky enough when we were at the Avalon Air Show to sit down with the guys that look after all of the virtual reality trainers for the PC-21. And I was lucky enough to sit in the virtual reality and fly a couple of sorties. And for the people at home listening and wondering what all that is, so what it was is it was a laptop computer, and it was just a regular Oculus Rift virtual reality trainer that I wore, and the instructor started the lesson for me, and I could hear the instructor in my ear, and I could see the cockpit of the aircraft in the front seat, and it was crystal clear. Everything was really good, and I flew the sortie, and I just watched, and I just listened, and I guess as a trainee pilot, I could sit there and watch that 10 or 20 or 30 times if I wanted to understand what was about to happen when I actually go and do that for real. And after, I don't know, it must have been 15 or 20 minutes of, I think I did some spins and I did a couple of circuits and there was some other stuff that I did as well. I thought, man, now I know exactly where the aeroplane needs to be in relation to where we're going. I could see what the circuit looked like. I could see, you know, where my wingtips needed to be. I could look over my shoulder with the VR and see the perfect 45. I could work out my approach speeds. It was like just like a revolutionary way in learning how to fly an aeroplane.
Yeah, it is, absolutely, Rob. It's a revolutionary way to fly an aircraft. It's got some new pieces of kit in there that's going to allow us to train people quicker and to a higher standard. And one of them, for instance, is the head-up display. And that's effectively what the rest of the ADF is now fitted with, head-up display. And so a graduating pilot who comes out with skill sets being able to handle a head-up display and use that automatically is a fantastic attribute to have in a qualified pilot. Not only that, but the use of the flight management system, which is a very capable computer that allows the aircraft to navigate accurately around the sky and fly instrument approaches, again, is another attribute that they're going to need to be able to operate the hardware at the sharp end of the airport.
Yeah, I kind of, after, you know, 20 minutes of sitting in the virtual reality simulator and you know, there's no controls for the people listening. There's no HOTAS, there's no throttle, and there's no stick for me to play with. There's just me sitting in the fictitious cockpit of the PC-21, watching and listening to the instructor and working out where I need to be in the particular sortie. After I finished, I was like, yeah, okay, now I could go fly circuits in this thing. I know exactly what the airspeeds need to be. I know where my attitude needs to be. I know what my approach speed needs to be. And just after watching it four or five times, it was like that learning by osmosis, and then you get to go and do it. That must shorten the training cycle considerably when somebody gets to do it like that.
Yeah, well, that's what I think the Air Force is hoping for, and I think that's what they're going to get. It's a platform that allows quicker learning than the analog of the PC-9, and there's just so many more tools there that are available to the trainee to be able to pick up the skill set required to operate the modern aircraft that we have in the entire ADF. And really looking forward to being a part of it. And we've already started at sea sale.
I saw a real practical thing. So I had a practical question about it because it's a faster aeroplane. It's a slippery aeroplane. And I learned to fly just in a little bug smasher like a lot of people, just in a little Cessna 152. And the thing is slow. It's really, really slow. When you think about the things that I could fly today, and not really that much faster as a private pilot, but when I think about a Cessna 152, that thing crosses the fence slowly. And in my mind, I was sort of thinking that a PC-21 is crossing the fence a lot faster. And if you're learning to fly in a PC-21 with no experience, that must be like hard to get ahead of the airplane. You've got to really do that quickly. You've got it's a steep learning curve. And I was sort of like, oh man, I don't know how I would handle that as a low-time baby pilot, I suppose. But after sitting in the virtual reality for 15 or 20 minutes, it really helped me to understand what the picture looked like. It helped me to understand where my speed should be, where my attitude should be, and things like that. So it was really good. What about the new pilots that are coming through that are transitioning onto it now? Are they having any trouble with the faster, slippery aeroplane?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Rob, when you said that you picked it up pretty quickly in the virtual reality sim. And not having flown the aircraft before, the trainee's going to be in the same boat. So they will obviously be able to fly simulation devices before they go flying for the first time. Plus, they've been fire hosed with information in regards to the systems of the aircraft. So they'll be pretty swept up when it comes to systems, how to fly it, and then they'll do numerous cockpit procedure trainer events, flight training device, which is the simulator events, numerous tutorials and discussions about how to fly. So I think by the time they actually get into the cockpit, they'll be really looking forward to the opportunity. However, it's still a fairly modern piece of kit with a lot of bells and whistles, and you're right, it does go quickly. So it takes a little bit of time to get used to the speed of things in that PC-21. But like you said, they pick it up pretty quickly in the simulation devices and the aircraft. And we're certainly looking forward to graduating some instructors and some pilots.
And have you been part of the new instruction with students and teaching new instructors yet? Have you managed to spread your instructor wings on the PC-21, so to speak?
Yeah, I do actually. I'm a member of Central Flying School as a reservist there, and so I enjoy flying with the FIC, the Flying Instructors Course, and we have qualified pilots there who are training to be instructors, who will go either to 1 FPS at Sail or 2 FPS over at Pierce on the PC-21. So I'm lucky and feel privileged to be a part of that unit, to be able to nurture and train fellow ADF aviators to become instructors. So, and we're doing our first course on the 21 now.
Oh, that's fantastic and beautifully said. And I want to just to kind of close out the podcast here by asking something completely from the other end of the spectrum, because you're at the sharp end of the training spear there, so to speak, with the latest hardware in the ADF and the best training aids in the world. And that's really cool to see, and thank you so much for sharing that with the audience. And for the budding Air Force pilots out there, or ADF pilots out there wanting to know more, it's a really good insight to what's actually happening. But at the very other end of the spectrum there, on the weekend, you mentioned earlier in the podcast there that you're out there flying warbirds. What sort of warbirds are you out there flying?
I fly the Nanchang, which is a Chinese tandem seat radial engine trainer.
Back to the radial.
Built pretty strong. Yeah, back to the radial. It's the sound of freedom, Rob. It's just a beautiful outlet on the weekend. So I often take passengers out there at the moment around Melbourne and Combat Flights Melbourne, and we do some aerobatics there, and sometimes we join up and do formation aerobatics and over the bay there. So that's a fantastic outlet where I just enjoy flying the radial and crack the cockpit and put arms on the side and let the air go through the hair. It's pretty cool.
And it's flying during the week for the Air Force, and it's flying on the week for fun. Is there something else in there that's not aviation, or nah?
Ride that motorbike every now and then, mate. A little bit of a sanity pill.
Nice one. Love it. Well, JT, thank you so much for spending some time with us here on the Australian Aviation Podcast. If people interested in learning to fly in the Australian Defence Force, what's the best way for them to find out more information about that?
The best way is in the normal way. So they log on to defencejobs.gov.au or the phone number there, I think, is 13901. Not that I've applied for some time, mate, but I think that's the number. And certainly they'll put you on the right track to become an ADF pilot.
Fantastic, mate. Well, thanks again for coming on the Australian Aviation Podcast, mate. We look forward to speaking with you again soon. That's bye for now.